Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up? Don't sit down. Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Well, good afternoon to another exciting episode of Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie. And today we do not have Cool Mike with us. He had an emergency business meeting. So instead, joining me as my co-host is Dr. C. Robert Jones. Good afternoon, Doc Jones.
Hey, good afternoon, Annie. I'm glad to be here helping out while Mike is away at his business meeting. I heard there's going to be a great show today, and your guest. Wow, I've been reading up and studying some of the books that he's written, and I'm impressed. That's all I can say.
All right, we'll bring our guest on in just a minute, and I'm glad there's a doctor in the house because I came down with the flu. So for the last 2 days, I've been hugging the porcelain god. So if you get a little bit dead air, I'm probably running. Anyway. Just to remind everyone, here in Beaufort, South Carolina, we have our Healing Heroes Golf Week, which started yesterday, and we will be broadcasting live from the Cat Island Golf Course called The Sanctuary, where Southern Sense has sponsored one of the holes there, and this Healing Heroes Golf Week is sponsored by the Independence Fund. For more information, go to independencefund.org or LDW3.com. And this is to help our severely wounded military veterans. And we're going to have a lot of fun on Thursday. Also, we have the Tea Party Express will be in Fort Wayne, Indiana, with my friend Emery McLennan's Tea Party called the Fort Wayne, Indiana Tea Party. And this will be this Sunday, the 29th, at 12:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. This is Central Standard Time. And the location is 6001 North Clinton Street, Washington Square Shopping Center, which is near the corner of Washington Center Road and North Clinton. They're going to have music, speakers, and fun. So for more information, You can go to teapartyexpress.org and you can pull that information up. So it's got a busy, busy week around here. So let us bring our guest on. He's the best-selling author, James Best. Good afternoon, Mr. Best.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Or should I say good morning, because you're a couple hours behind.
Yeah, I'm in Arizona, and we're on Pacific Standard Time.
All right. You've got a brand-new book out. I had the name right in front of me.
Principled Action, Lessons Thanks. From the Origins of the American Republic, which is actually a quote, part of a quote from James Madison. I don't have it in front of me, but he said something along the lines of, other countries' origins are veiled in fable, but there are lessons from the origins of the American Republic that Americans ought not to be denied. So he thought that the way the country was formed was important for people down through the ages to hear and understand.
Unfortunately, I wish Congress would, every last one of them would read this book. Maybe they'll understand why the Constitution was written the way it is and why it's the foundation and not a living document.
Right. I think we're going to be in agreement on this program.
I have to let you know I'm the co-founder and webmaster for the Beaufort, South Carolina Tea Party, so you can't get anyone more conservative than me.
Okay.
All right, now what's the premise of this book? Now, you had originally written another book prior to this, and this is sort of like a follow-up to it.
Correct. But I think of it as a companion book to Tempest at Dawn. Could I go back a little bit on why I wrote that first book?
Please, go ahead.
I was a consultant. I spent a lot of time in hotel rooms, and I was in Boston on a job, and I picked up a book called Decision in Philadelphia by Christopher Collier. And I thought, I was a history minor and an econ major, and I thought I knew something about American history, and I was just shocked at the drama involved in the convention and how close it came to failing so many times, and the people that were involved in it, how they kept pulling it back from the brink until they finally came out and introduced the Constitution for ratification. And so then I got another book, and I was reading it, and one of the introductions, they said, someone really, this is a historian, someone who knows how to write fiction really ought to write a novel on this, because it is a story. And I had written a couple magazine columns, I had written one book, but it was called Digital Organization, and it was a computer management book. So I not only had only written nonfiction, but I had written technical nonfiction. So I jumped in where fools dare to go, or I'm not sure how that phrase goes, but it took up 8 years of my life, because I think I read every book published to that point on the Constitution. And I at least did a thorough scan of three biographies of every major player, because I wanted to get different perspectives. And it was a scary endeavor, because I was actually writing dialogue for people like George Washington, Ben Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison. And I didn't want to be out of character for them. But the whole purpose of the novel, and the reason I wanted to know, is I wanted to bring these people to life and not in the dry context of either a marble statue in Washington, D.C., or a history book where it's a pretty dry dissertation on what they did. So anyways, I got off on this tangent and ended up writing Tempest at Dawn. And then I was, when my agent was trying to market it, I was in the writing mood or habit, and so I just knocked off a Western in 4 months, and that's how I got into the Westerns.
Now, you take a little bit of a literary license. Some people, you've credited speeches to others, and you've changed just a few things, but you basically stuck to the actual history.
What I tried to do is everything inside the chamber that occurred in the what we call Independence Hall now, was accurate to Madison's notes or other notes from other delegates, but mostly Madison's notes. And but in a novel, in a story, you can't have 55 characters. It just drives the reader crazy. So sometimes I took something that someone said from South Carolina and I attributed to a character already established from South Carolina. And I think in almost every case, except one significant one, I kept the same state. And then there was one angry speech by Bedford that I already had someone set up as a antagonist. I had him give that speech.
Now, I'm just curious. You said you read a lot of books on the Constitution, and unfortunately, you're finding schools are not teaching true history. They're just picking instead of going through actual timelines. And I was fortunate to go to school at a time where history was being taught. And I'm wondering, have you read the book by Louise and Brodus Mitchell, The Biography of the Constitution?
No, I haven't read that one.
Oh, all right. Because that's sort of like along the same lines of what you've done, but they're actually, it's not done as a dialogue or anything. It is done as a history book.
Yes. Actually, I finished Tempest at Dawn in 1998, and it didn't sell. I mean, it was shopped by a good New York agent who was very enthusiastic for it, but it didn't sell. And about 2 years ago, it's not been about a year and a half ago, because of all the interest in the Constitution, I drug it out and self-published it myself, and it's done very well.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Look, I love the premise of it because I was reading the intro to it that you have up on the Internet, and I was riveted, and I'm going, all right, who is this kid talking to? And he's saying Mr. President, and then you're giving like a little bit of hints, like Virginia and so on and so forth. So I'm going, is this Washington? Is this Jefferson? And also I come through, and it's Madison, and I said, oh, my God, you got me.
Well, good, because that's what I was trying to do.
Oh, man. Now, your book is up on Blogspot. I believe it's jamesbest.blogspot.com.
Yes, it is.
Oh, fantastic. Doc Jones.
Yeah, Mr. Best. My name is Clarence Jones. I'm co-hosting with Annie today. And I am an historian, and I work with some of the news organizations, A&E, Discovery, Nat Geo, those kinds of things. My question is, when I read some of the excerpts from your book, and I'm here on your webpage right now, I can't help but think a little bit of Gore Vidal's novels, like for example, Lincoln, Empire, Hollywood. Were any of his works an influence on you in your writing?
Oh, yeah. I did read Gore Vidal's books, and they were an influence, but an opposite influence of what you might be saying. I didn't mm-hmm. care for the way he approached history, especially Burr. And so it did have an influence. I did. When I said I read over 100 books in preparing this one, and a lot of those books I read were historical novels or novelizations right. of historical events, so I could see how other people approached it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, he was an influence.
Okay, he was an influence, but he was not a positive influence, and if not, why was he not?
Well, this is going to sound strange, but I thought a large portions of his books were boring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I probably modernized language more than he did.
Yeah.
And that was in an attempt to keep the reader's interest. So a lot of the quotes that are in there and in the mouths of the characters are things they, well, actually wrote, because we didn't have tape recorders. But I've modernized the language such that you couldn't use attribution for it, obviously. And then, I mean, this is a minor thing, but all of Madison's notes were in third person past tense. And, of course, I changed them to first person present tense.
Okay.
Now, go ahead, Doc.
Yeah.
So in reading principled actions, if I read that, well, no, not if, but when I read this,
I'm sorry about that.
There won't be a specific. There won't be any correlation between, say, Lincoln and principled action. I won't be reminded of it, or.
No, I don't think so. Principled action. I was invited by Beck to do a lecture in what he had, I think it's still up, called Beck University, on the founding principles, and or first principles are frequently called. And I went all over and I couldn't find any list of what those were.
Mm-hmm.
And so having written the Tempest at Dawn, I just put my mind in theirs and said, what would they agree on when they arrived in Philadelphia? And so that's how I came up with the principles that are outlined in Principled Action. And I gave a lecture on that. And then that became fairly popular. I had a lot of people talking about it. I actually made that presentation at a number of Tea Party groups. And as a result, then I eventually put that in a book. And it, whereas Tempest at Dawn is, you know, show, don't tell, and I'm not very explicit about some of the principles that they were supporting. Actually, I think I am, but in a different way. But Principled Action is more of a traditional history book that just, you know, goes through a descriptive narrative and explains what the principles were and how people felt about things at that time.
Now, you had, in the book, you stressed what the basic principles were. And one of them, the rights come from God, not government. And that's something we argue over with the progressives all the time. You want to elaborate on that?
Yes, I think that's the whole that's actually an Enlightenment. It actually comes from, well, before the Enlightenment, and then it was brought back into popularity by the Enlightenment. I personally think that the American Revolution and then the Constitutional Convention was kind of like the climax or the highlight of the Enlightenment period. And up until then, God ordained a family to rule. And so when a king died, his prodigy then became the rulers. And this whole idea, and then they issued rights and everything else. And what the Declaration of Independence did in the whole revolutionary period is it threw everything, it just flipped it over. And it said that, no, rights come from God. Our first obligation is to God, and our second obligation is to the government. And so the government cannot issue rights. And if you look at the Bill of Rights, and it's filled with nothing but a lot of phrases that says, you can't do this, you can't abridge this right, you can't do this. And they're actually instructions from we the people to the government of what rights they're not to interfere with. Nothing in the Bill of Rights actually issues these rights to Americans. It's trying to protect Americans from those rights being infringed by government, which is the founders all believe that the greatest risk of getting of tyranny and of getting rights abused is from government.
Yeah, one of the things I've always argued is that you think about it, when you're born, you have the choice where your path is going to go. You know, even if you're born into certain situations, but you end up making conscious decisions. And it's government and society that determines that, no, you cannot turn left, you can only turn right. You cannot go straight, you can always walk backwards. They determine how to restrict your movements. So therefore, saying that your rights come from God is basically saying you're coming naked into the world with total freedom.
That's why they're called natural rights most of the time, or first principles. That, you're absolutely right. That is the philosophical derivative of rights come from God. You're born with them. And that is the basis behind all men are created equal.
Now, because we are born with natural rights, God-given rights, that also means then that when we do represent ourselves, all political power comes from us, we the people, and not from just a pure king.
Correct. In fact, the Constitution is ours. I mean, there's a weird situation here where we make all these politicians, the president, Supreme Court justice, members of Congress, swear to uphold the Constitution. Well, the Constitution is a restraining order on those individuals. It's our document. It's not theirs. It never was theirs. So it's not their responsibility to uphold it. It's the people's responsibility to uphold the Constitution.
Yeah, and now with the Constitution in place, the Constitution has to be actually a written document to help restrict government and prevent people from saying, oh, well, you know, I really didn't mean that or want to say that. Meanwhile, you know, you can shake a hand and agree on something, an implied contract known as, whereas a written contract is now enforceable, where an implied one most likely is not enforced.
I'm in a complete agreement. When the Constitution was issued from Philadelphia, it was not the supreme law of the land. It had to be ratified by state conventions, and those state conventions were not connected to the state legislature or the national government. So it was the people who had to ratify and say that this was, that they were agreeing that this would be the law of the land, the supreme law of the land.
Now, when you were doing the research on the Constitutional Convention, what did you find the most interesting thing that, about, you know, what was going on during those, what was it, 8 months? Those 55 men were sitting there?
No, it was 4 months that they were sitting there, and then somewhere between 1 and 2 years for all the ratification conventions. I think the most interesting thing to me, and many historians may disagree, is how I believe active a role George Washington played and how he really I believe, orchestrated events to a much greater degree than he was given credit for. Now, if you read any book on the Constitution, they'll always tell you that he was elected president of the convention and only said one thing during the entire convention, other than, you know, parliamentary directions. But behind the scenes, if you studied his politics, he wasn't someone who would be overtly out there. Plus, everybody in that room knew that the first president of the United States was going to be George Washington. And I believe he did not want to be seen as orchestrating his own regime or defining what the government would be like that he would lead. So he stayed in the background. But there were a whole number of situations where that convention was deadlocked. It wasn't going to go anywhere. People were literally storming out, saying they were going to go home. And the person who brought it back together, actually there were two, is Ben Franklin and George Washington, but they worked together and kept it going and kept the people together until they finally hammered out a constitution.
Yeah, and he was the binding, the complete binder on this. But Ben Franklin was also instrumental, even though he was extremely sick and weak at one point where they were in total disarray. He brought in a minister and had everyone kneel together in prayer.
Yeah, he I don't know if you've heard this story, but supposedly when he first proposed that, Alexander Hamilton objected and said that that they didn't need foreign aid. he was outvoted, of course. But yes, Franklin, his absolutely indispensable contribution to the Constitutional Convention. He didn't really offer too much that was put into the design. The one thing he's best known for is that the House of Representatives has to initiate money bills. But other than that, very little. But he diffused tempers every time things got very heated. And he did them sometimes with humor, and he would tell a humorous story and get everyone laughing, sometimes with prayer, and oftentimes, quite frankly, he just filibustered. And he would start speaking and just talk until people, caught a breath and relaxed a little bit, and they'd get back to business. But, yeah, it was almost like his assigned role in the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, now, what I found most interesting is that, you know, I've been to Philadelphia once, I think, in my life, but was the climate and how many people were getting sick from not malaria. I'm trying to think of what one of those other insect-borne diseases. Doc Jones, give me a hand here.
Well, I was just thinking of my next question. So let me go ahead and ask it because I can't think of it either. I've long considered writing myself, and Gore Vidal influenced me to write fictional historical novels. My question to you is, what books or authors have influenced you to write? And what motivated you to begin writing? There's two questions.
Yeah. First, let's do the motivation to write first. For some reason, right in high school, from high school, I always wanted to be a writer. Then hunger kind of got in the way, and I went and got a job where I worked.
Yeah.
And I went into the computers, and I started, I satisfied my need to write by writing technical journal articles. And in my bio, it says I wrote two magazine columns. They were for computer magazines. So I had some regular columns and stuff I wrote there. So I kind of, worked my career and wrote a little bit on the side and wrote nonfiction. And I tried my hand in the 80s to write a novel. And this agent finally, after dozens of rejections, finally wrote me a personal letter and said that I was just perfectly awful and that I should understand that fiction writing was a profession and it was done professionally and I wasn't making it. So that's why I went back to nonfiction. So when I started writing Tempest at Dawn, or deciding to write it, I read over 100 books, and it's actually well over 100, but about a dozen of them were on the craft of fiction writing. And so I did learn from that first book that I needed, that this was something that you had to study and learn how to do. And it was nothing like nonfiction writing, which by then I had a book published that was nonfiction. So I always had the motivation to write. My wife asked me why, when I was in Boston, I kept writing on this book, and I told her when I got back to the hotel room after work, there was nothing else I'd rather do. So that's why I wrote, and I've been in a lot of conferences and spoke and had people ask me questions about, it's so hard to write, and I says, then you'll probably never be a writer if you want to know the truth, because everyone I've known who's been a good writer has loved it and almost would always write rather than do anything else. If they had the opportunity. So it takes a kind of a desire. And I think that answers your second question, but I can't remember what your first one was.
Yeah. What books and authors influenced you in your life and writing? Your life?
I think one of my favorite books, and I've read it several times, is Ben Franklin's autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's probably the best historical novel ever written. I'm making a joke there. I'm sure there's a lot of fiction in it, knowing Ben Franklin. Tendency to tell a tale. But basically, all the facts are correct. Also, the decision in Philadelphia, Collier did influence me a lot. In fact, I even went to the Boston Library and went down the basement, and Microfiche found his doctoral thesis on Roger Sherman. This is going to sound weird and not quite fit this, but The Virginian was a major influence. And this book, of course, has a kind of, is a stretch, but it's from a structure standpoint, Cain and Abel. And I can't remember who wrote Cain and Abel. But every other chapter flipped point of view between two characters. And yep. That's where I picked that idea up. And Tempest at Dawn flips between Roger Sherman and James Madison every other chapter, which was one of the harder things to pull off. If I think of some other books, I'll let you know. But
yeah, well, I see how you came up with the title. I can read where you how you came to the title of Principled Action. How did you come about the titles
Tempest at Dawn.
Tempest at Dawn. Yes. I mean, I love it. I love the title. How did you come about that?
That's about the seventh or eighth title that I had for the book. And I wanted to convey that it was a pretty stormy period in the country's life. In fact, as many problems as we have today in our economy and in our government, they were just as bad or worse, arguably, in 1787. So
mm-hmm.
I wanted to convey that we didn't start off with a couple shots heard around the world. In fact, a lot of people don't even understand the extent and length of the revolution.
Yeah.
So it was the whole period was very stormy, and it was the beginning of the country. So it was a storm at the beginning of the country. So that's how I came up with the title.
All right. Listening to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Annie, the Radio Chick. Our guest is James Best, a best-selling author. And my co-host today is not Cool Mike, it's Doc Jones. Our call-in lines are open, which is 917-889-3675. Now, James, you maintain a personal blog, too, and I was reading some of the articles on it, and one of them I found fascinating. You titled, Will Americans Ever See the Real Barack Obama? Do you think we ever will see that mask come off his face?
I want it to come off. Will it come off? I think it's going to depend now, it appears, on Romney. And if Romney, I heard that Paul Ryan told him that he had to have three strategies to win this election: stay on offense, stay on offense, stay on offense. And I agree with that. And he's going to have to force the president to show his true self, because he's not going to do it on his own. So I don't know. Because the man, as I mentioned in that article, he often does exactly the opposite of what he's saying, and I believe that when he's the most vocal about something is when he's trying to disguise that he's doing the opposite. And so if the American public just listens to what he says, that's why they don't believe that what he's doing is damaging as I believe it is.
Now, it's funny because we had another author on, Mondo Frazier, who wrote the book The Secret Life of Barack Hussein Obama. And, you know, the facts are out there, but no one in the mainstream media is broadcasting them.
Correct. And I've listened to your show once, and I think it might have been the last program you had on. It was a woman who had made that film.
Yeah, Bettina Sofia Viviano.
Right. That was a very good show.
Thank you.
Pretty animated guest on that show. Anyways, I think she explained a lot of why he's gotten away with so much. Is I relate him to Eddie Haskell growing up. Do you know who Eddie Haskell was?
Of course.
Leave It to Beaver.
Right, and he always did something wrong, and then he always lied his way out of it and blamed it on the beef. And I just, every time I look at Barack Obama, I think, oh, man, this is Eddie Haskell grown up.
Yeah. I think the same way. In fact, yeah. Let me get one question in here before we go too far, before I forget it. I'm getting up there in years, and I have a question and wait too long to ask it. Next thing you know, I can't remember what it is. Will any of your books be in audio book form? Are there any out there available now? For example, I would love to. I mean, as Annie knows, and a lot of the other Blog Talk folks know, I like to take road trips. I like to take long drives, and I listen to my good friend Glenn Beck's work, the Overton Window, and I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it on a road trip, and I think that I certainly would really enjoy your book, taking a nice long road trip out to, say, Buford this weekend, or where Annie is hosting her event. Will you have an audio book?
Well, the good news is the Westerns are in audio. But the audio publisher for me, which is Books in Motion, has not agreed to do Tempest at Dawn. I haven't approached him on Principled Action, which I'm glad you just reminded me I will approach him. Tempest at Dawn, the problem with audiobooks is they hire actors to read them. And to read a Western, it's you know, 70,000 words. They can do it relatively quickly. And it never, it has no shelf life, so they can generate revenue over a long period. Of course, Tempest at Dawn doesn't have a shelf life either. But it's very long, and it would take a very long reading. And so what they've told me so far is just financially, they don't see enough of a market to justify the cost of recording.
Got it.
Paying an actor. Maybe someday I'll record it. But
well, I have a nice sample of the book here on Google Books of Principled Action, and I was just going through it during the course of the interview, and you know, I'm sold on it right now. I'm going to go ahead and get myself a copy. Unfortunately, I can't get it here on Google Books, but there's a nice long list of where I can get it: Barnes and Noble, Amazon.com, Wheatmark, and Books a Million. So I'm looking forward to getting my copy sometime later this evening. But I really would appreciate, I know a lot of people like to go to audiobooks, and you know, when they're taking nice long drives, a lot of my friends do. But right now I'm thoroughly enthralled in this book, and you know, for whatever it's worth, you know, you still reminded me a little bit with this book of Gore Vidal's Lincoln. Just a little. And I hope that's not an insult to you.
No, it's not an insult at all. He is a very good writer. By the way, if you're interested in the Westerns, they're at audible.com.
Ah, got it. Okay, great.
All right, we got a caller on the line that's been waiting patiently. He's also a fellow BTR host. He's known as the Invisible Conservative. Thomas, good afternoon.
Hi, Annie.
How are you doing? You have a question for our guest, Thomas?
Actually, I had a comment, not a question, because Doc Jones asked the question, do we think the mask will ever come off of Obama? And I just wanted to comment on that, because that's a good point, and that's a good question. And my comment to that is that it just depends on how you look at it. If we continue to look at it from the scope or the standpoint of, you know, our economy is being destroyed and stuff like that, which it is by his actions, that's true. But those situations, in my belief and estimation, is just a that's just a symptom of a far deeper rooted problem. And the fact of the matter is, people don't want to call him what he really is. Barack Obama is one of the most evil individuals I have ever seen. And I'm gonna put it real. And Annie, you know me. I'm not afraid to tell on myself. When he was elected, I cried because I was so angry. And I was on the phone with my cousin, and I told her, these were my exact words. I said, Hopi, this man will go down as the most corrupt and the most evil person in the history of this country. Those were my words, and that's starting to be borne out. So Barack Obama's evil. He always has been, but it just depends on how we as conservatives look at it. If we continue to look at it from, say, from a, like they like to divide it, fiscal conservative point of view and versus social, instead of looking at the whole big picture, we will never see that man for what he truly is. And that's my comment.
Okay, wow. Now, you know, it's funny because we can't access any of his information because shortly after he took office, he signed an executive order
right.
sealing all of his past records. And
right.
you know, ever wonder why there is no ex-girlfriend, you know, anyone that knew him in school has come forward? I don't know. Do you find that interesting, James?
Could I make a comment here?
Sure.
I lived in Boston for a few years and worked in Boston for a lot of years. And when Kerry was running, I saw it in the Boston Globe. I didn't see it anywhere else, that Kerry had 8 girlfriends
wow.
prior to his, I can't remember his wife's name. And
Teresa
that,
Hines.
Yeah, prior to Teresa. And all 8 girlfriends, ex-girlfriends, donated to his opponent in the primary, and one of the girlfriends donated to all of his opponents in the primary. I don't think Obama has controlled the media in his life to such an extent. If anything like that were to happen with him, I don't think it would come out and it wouldn't be printed in the paper.
Wow. Now, it's funny. You mentioned that you used to live in Boston. I used to work up there, 84 to 86. I worked for American Express down at Government Center. And, you know, I found being conservative in the middle of Massachusetts was one of the hardest things to do.
Whoops.
How about being conservative in a very Democratic company in the middle of Boston?
Wow. That's funny.
Oh, man. I was up there 82 to 86. What years were you up?
I worked there from 97 to 2010, 11, 2011.
Wow.
And I worked for Grand Circle Travel, which was a travel company there, originally consulting with them, and then eventually I went to work with them for a couple of years and then returned to Arizona after that.
Oh.
But getting the mask off Obama, another thing that occurred to me while your caller was talking is this week he made this statement about how much he supports capitalism and he thinks that free enterprise and capitalism are the best invention for the betterment of man in the history of the world or something along those lines. And I'm sitting there listening to this, and I'm thinking, this man doesn't believe a word he's saying.
True.
It's funny that you mentioned something like that because it was just last month, Bill Ayers was at one of these major Occupy rallies or whatever it is. He actually made a statement that he wakes up every day hoping to kill capitalism. I'm trying to see if I got the clip. I know I, yeah. This. I listened to it and I said, oh, my God, here's Bill Ayers at Occupy.
I get blamed a lot for being an optimist. I get accused of being an optimist. Because an optimist assumes that they know how things are going to turn out, and I have no fucking idea. That I will not know how things are going to turn out. I think it's unknowable. I think the future is unknowable. So I'm not a pessimist either. People who are pessimists and cynics think they know what's going to happen. I instead choose to to nourish what I call a politics of confidence. That is, I get up every morning thinking, today I'm going to make a difference. Today I'm going to impact. Today I'm going to make a revolution. I go to bed every night disappointed, but I'm back to go tomorrow. And that's the only way you can do it. And I think you have to have a smile on your face, a song in your heart, new humor, new guidance.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, brother.
It's a pleasure. I'm sorry, the audio wasn't better than that. Every day he wakes up, he wants to end capitalism.
Yeah, every day morning he wakes up, he thinks this will be the day I might be able to kill capitalism or something like that. Unbelievable quote, but not really startling if you have any familiarity with these people.
Yep.
So we are known by
the company we keep. I didn't state that correctly, but I think we all get the point. Bill Ayers, Reverend Wright, and all of the sycophants and socialists and Marxists that Obama has associated himself with, for him to state that he loves capitalism and that he supports capitalism simply flies in the face of anything that makes any sense whatsoever. The man is completely and utterly not pro-capitalist. Everything that he's done has suggested that capitalism doesn't work. He so much has said it on numerous occasions. He didn't outright say that capitalism doesn't work, but when he talks about the system and when he talks about how businesses run, and then he goes on to state in the same breath, it doesn't work, we know exactly what he's talking about. I think.
I agree.
I would basically say President Obama is actually an amoral man. You know, it's like the old saying goes, what's the difference between an ethical man and a moral man? An ethical man knows it's wrong to cheat on his wife. A moral man will not cheat on his wife. And what we have is Obama cheating on America.
That's true.
Yes.
Now, Mr. Best, do you, and I'm sorry if I cut you off,
do you anticipate
writing any books that speak to the current administration or anything of that that type?
No books. No. I do blog on what would the founders think. I've done several on Patriot Post, and I do it on Constituting America.
Okay.
And I'll do blogs because to really make a big impact with a book, you need a TV show or some platform that you can really promote it, or you got to commit a high profile felony so you can get
mm-hmm.
But
got it.
But with a blog or a series of blogs, because I'm actually working on three and I have two requests to write for two others, I can feel like at least I'm making some influence. And it's more immediate as well.
Yeah, now we got Dana in the chat room asking a question. She wants to know how you would suggest we reestablish our constitutional republic.
All right, this is going to sound kind of common sense, but I'm very much in favor of a balanced budget amendment. And I think that would be a major step. And the reason, and I know there's a lot of faults with the balanced budget amendment, but most of the states, 49 of the states, operate under one. And the federal government can either print or borrow money and doesn't have to worry about that. And I know there'll be bookkeeping shenanigans and that kind of thing, even if there was a balanced budget amendment, but it would be the first step in equalizing the states versus the federal government, going back more in that direction. And once you, if you can help build the states back up, and they are becoming more aggressive in challenging the federal government, and the federal government's getting more aggressive in challenging them, then I think you have a chance of And especially if we can get a lot of good people elected at the state level, you have a chance of actually moving us back toward a constitutional government. But it's not going to happen in one fell swoop, and it's going to have to first be done by people, by electing people who support the constitutional, or I think the common phrase is constitutional.
Now, I don't know if you quote this, but I quote this on the news just before the show went on. There's a union in, I believe it's Pennsylvania. I may be right or wrong. It's a right-to-work state. And they are suing, saying that the right-to-work law in the state is unconstitutional based upon the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery. And they're saying, in essence, because they're paying dues for union representation that the non-union workers are getting the benefit of through better wages and benefits, that they are now considered themselves slaves. Is that not absolutely off the top of the wall?
I think so. I would hope that that wouldn't get much traction. But, you know, the courts, that's the most dangerous thing that we have challenging the Constitution. And it's the courts who have weakened it, not as much Congress. Congress has taken advantage of what the courts have allowed them to do. And so you think that looks like a ridiculous suit, but you just don't know what court it's going to land in and what the feelings are. And I know that a Supreme Court justice, for instance, is supposed to decide caseloads based on the law, and his credentials are supposed to count, and every single one is representative as someone who can make laws impartial and to the Constitution. And yet, if that were true, why would they demonize particular justices that are just as qualified and spend ungodly amount of money promoting justices that follow their political beliefs? So the progressives have made a career over a century, or at least 70 years, 80 years, I'd say, in basically packing the court.
Yeah. Now, Thomas has a comment. Thomas?
Hey, Annie, on that question, here's the thing. If you have a really good lawyer that goes up against that case and say they won, then that lawyer can then turn around and take that case and use it against the unions who are forcing those people to pay the dues. Because I'm not even a lawyer, but listening to you share that, it clicked into my head. Either they didn't really think that all out, because that can be turned back on them and used against them if there were the people who were smart enough to actually catch that. Because if I could catch that and I'm not a lawyer, what about our high-powered conservative attorneys? You know, it's time for us to go tit for tat. That's just my comment on that. Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, any sort of a court case can boomerang back on the people bringing the suit forward. Doc Jones.
Well, I'd like to go back if we can for a moment to your writing, because I find writers to be extremely talented and interesting people. Given that I'm unable to. to churn out a book myself, what's been your toughest criticism as a writer, as an author, and what's been your best compliment?
Ooh, boy, toughest criticism comes very close to home. It comes inside my house.
Mm-hmm.
It's my wife, and she can't tell me how to make it right, but she can sure tell me when I've missed and I got it wrong. And sometimes it's actually been more stressful than it should have been, because I should know by now. that she really doesn't know how to fix it. She just knows it's not working. And I should have learned by this time that she's always right. And I rework it and rework it after I settle down, usually a day later. And I realize, oh, my God, it's way better. So that's the toughest criticism I've gotten. I've actually had lots of reviews of the books, and they've all been good. I think they've all been good. I think I can say that. If you go on Goodreads, I get some bad reviews, especially for Shut Mouth Society. And the problem there was more people judging the book by the original cover, and it looked like a nonfiction Lincoln book, and it was a traditional thriller. And so I changed the cover, mostly because of the reviews I was getting, and realized it wasn't the book people thought they were buying. The best compliment is, it probably shouldn't have been the best, but it's the one that pleased me the most, was that Glenn Beck liked Tempest at Dawn and put it on his reading list and had me on his show a couple times. And that, without a doubt, was the compliment that I appreciated the most.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I saw that you had been up on the Glenn Beck doing the interviews. As a matter of fact, I think I had caught you one time while you were on. Now, you also do the mystery series, and I'm a mystery buff. I've got almost, I would say, about three quarters of Agatha Christie. I'm missing a handful of books, but I enjoy them. And I was unaware that you wrote mysteries also. And the Steve Dancy, I like the premise. You want to give us background on the character Steve Dancy?
Yeah, that's actually the best-selling of the books, all the whole series. In fact, it's doing very well. It's almost always in the top two, three selling Westerns at Christmas time. So it's a very frequent gift. Steve Dancy is a New York City shopkeeper, and he leaves New York City, and he goes west. The first book takes place in Nevada, mining town. And it's a non-traditional Western in the sense that, and I've actually gotten some criticism for this, by the way, is he's rich. And I've gotten some people who just objected to the fact that he was wealthy and used his money to help resolve problems. I don't want to give away the whole thing, but he develops a friendship with a mine owner and a captain of the Pinkertons, and those three characters are the continuing characters in all three books. The last one in the series is called Murder at Thumb Butte, and that literally is a murder mystery disguised as a Western. So I purposely did that. I thought, well, Western fans won't notice. They did, and so far I've gotten compliments on it. And I picked up some new readers who were into mysteries, which was the actual intent, was to broaden it, and then hopefully they would go back and read the prior two.
And
one last thing is Steve Dancy's 30. Sharp, who is the mine owner, is 50, and McCallan, who is the Pinkerton captain, is 40. So also is trying to appeal to all ages.
Now you just got to throw in a kid and a dog.
There is a kid in there. There is a kid, yeah.
Do you have any advice for aspiring writers such as myself, maybe Thomas, maybe Annie?
The first thing is write. So even if you don't think you're ready or you don't have the story ready, start it anyways. It's always rewriting is what makes a book good, not the writing of it the first time. And so my first advice would be to write. And my second advice would be to find an association of writers who can give you some honest feedback and some advice. And I just last night, we just have an informal group that doesn't even have a name. In fact, we call it the organization that doesn't exist. And we just all met at a restaurant last night at 5:30, and at 9:30 we left, and there was, I think, about 20 people there, all writers from the Phoenix area. And I think that that helps build confidence. I mean, everybody's got a story. And when you find out that, you know, it's not easy, but the first step is you got to just go do it. And I don't want to sound like a Nike commercial. But, yeah, I would say that would be my first piece of advice. The other thing is, this is probably going to offend some people, but one time when I was in Boston, I went and I bought the number one college textbook on creative writing. And I bought a Writing Novels for Dummies book, and then I bought a middle-level book. And the worst of all of them was the college creative writing book.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't even know that a novel was storytelling after reading it. You would think it was just a whole bunch of fancy mechanics. And I also thought that, and then the next worst one, of course, was the Writing for Dummies, which was very formulaic. So you do have to read these books, but I would suggest that you do not aim to write literature. And if you are going to write literature, write a good story first, and it'll eventually, you might work into literature. And then secondly, no story lasts, or no literature lasts generation to generation. That's not a good storytelling.
That's interesting. Now, Thomas had another question. Thomas?
Mr. Best, when can I expect to see a movie series on the Westerns?
Yeah, I would like to see that.
Oh, yeah,
that
great
show.
Question. Great question.
Yeah.
So what can we do to help jumpstart that process?
Well, I have had someone take a look at Shutmouth Society and Sirius look at it, but eventually they passed. And the reason they passed is it was a cable movie for a cable company,
mm-hmm.
and that market doesn't have a large budget. And they said that just the way the book was written, they didn't see a way around all the locations, and that would be too expensive. But I've not even had an inquiry on the Westerns.
If I could suggest, just based on listening to what you're talking about and a little bit that you shared about the books, a good cable channel that would probably be good for those books for a movie would be the Hallmark Channel.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. The problem is you got to get to the production companies that supply Hallmark, not Hallmark. Well, maybe if I get somebody in Hallmark that would like the idea, then they could promote it then to one of the production companies.
Well,
go ahead, Thomas.
Hallmark is headquartered here in Kansas City where I live. I could probably do a little digging around to find out who's in control of the media company and then pass the information to Annie and she could pass it on to you.
Well, that would be absolutely wonderful.
Okay,
well,
anyone
go ahead, Annie.
Now when you start the writing process and you sit down, are you using an old Mickey Spillane typewriter, or are you using a laptop, or how do you start off? Do you have some cookies, like your favorite cookies you've got sitting down, maybe some coffee, or what? How does the next book start?
This is going to sound weird, but it's true. I can write anywhere for any length of time. So I have walked home from work in Boston because I lived in the town and stopped in the park on a bench and wrote for 15 minutes and then closed my laptop and walked home. I have probably worked as long as 9, maybe 10 hours.
Wow.
But that's rare.
What do you use? Dell? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish that.
I would say more normal is 5 hours is a really heavy day of writing for me,
mm-hmm.
and I write on Word and on a laptop,
okay.
And the place where I write the most is a leather club chair with an ottoman and tables on either side of it, and then the computer on one of those old tables on my lap. And that's where I do most of the writing. And I do have something next to me. It's not cookies. It's a cup of coffee.
Got it. Starbucks or something made in the kitchen?
I'm sorry?
Next, you're going to ask if it's boxes or briefs.
Yeah, it's actually Starbucks Verona, if you want to know, but I don't think that's a secret to my writing. But I make it at home.
Now, you said you're using Word, so you're not using any specific writing software. Is that correct?
Correct.
No, it's just plain old Word. Okay.
Right. Blank page doesn't scare me.
Got it. Okay.
Now, let's get back. Your website is up on Blogspot. It's jamesbest.blogspot.com. People can go there and get your books, too, by clicking on the book icon, right?
Correct.
And they can read some of the articles that you've written on the blog. Now, I want to ask your opinion about the upcoming elections. And there's been a lot of stories about a possibility, you know, of the 2012 elections being rigged. Do you think we have an honest and fair chance on this one?
No. that's not even the right question. It's how fair and how honest will it be? Because there'll definitely be some dishonesty, and it definitely will be somewhat unfair. I think it'll be very possibly the most dishonest election in history, and I'm very concerned about this, and not only your program that you had last week, but I think Fox had a program on Sunday night on voter fraud as well. And I know in this state, it's, I would say, the, at the present time, number one concern of the Tea Party, at least the two Tea Parties that I attend, concern is voter fraud for the next election. More than candidates or anything else.
Yeah, because Bettina has been doing that film about the 2008, and recently the administration has endorsed Skidel, which is linked to George Soros, as counting the ballots, and accounting is with a company that has no American offices. They're based out of France. It's mind-boggling the ways that are being put in place to actually steal the election.
Yeah, and I did a Google search on that a couple days ago, and there's very little information reporting on it. I mean, Drudge, I think, broke the story. At least that's what I had heard. And, Reid won. I don't know how the hell he won, but he had SCIU counting or taking care of the machines in Nevada during his election.
Interesting. Now, Thomas said he has something going on behind the scenes. He has a comment. Thomas?
You know what, Annie? A friend of mine who I think you may have interviewed on your show, I'm not sure. I don't want to say his name, but anyway, he's a former Marine, a retired Marine, and he was on my show a while back, and then we were also talking on the phone, and he shared something with me. And I don't know if the one little element that we are forgetting about while everything is going on. Yes, this administration is weakening our military, but what my friend has shared with me, that there are some ramblings and some goings on behind the scene that our military is preparing to, if they have to, they're preparing to take this current administration and government down. I don't know if anybody else heard that, but he was the second person that had mentioned that to me in passing. So I said all that to say this: don't give up on this nation just yet, because what the left is doing, they are severely underestimating the resolve of our military. They really are. And I personally want them to keep being stupid like that.
Now, that's interesting, because yesterday John Boehner was on, with Brett Baer.
On Fox?
On Fox. And he had mentioned saying that this upcoming election in November is possibly the most important election ever in the nation's history. You feel that's the truth, James?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to set the direction of this country. It's either going to put it back on a constitutional path, or one of the articles that one of the blogs I wrote is Who's Afraid of France, and I don't believe France is the model that Obama admires. I think this is going to really offend some people, and that I mean it in the dictionary sense of the word. I don't think he's a socialist. I think he's a fascist, which is crony capitalism on steroids. That's all fascism. It's a form of socialism, but it's a tight connection between the connected corporations, large corporations, and the government. And that's what I see coming, and gets me concerned. And I do think that this is a very serious election.
Yeah, and people don't understand the difference between fascism and socialism. Where under fascism, companies and government become partners. World War II, Hitler had employed Krupps, which people think coffee machines. No, they were the biggest manufacturer of munitions. You had Mercedes-Benz, VW, and they all were in bed with Hitler's government.
As were the medical insurance companies, AARP, you can just go on and on, the auto companies, and a lot of the investment companies on Wall Street with the Obama administration.
Yeah, now we're having a thing going on with Fisker where they want to put some sort of a government audit and control over them, because they were given, I think it was $2 billion in bailout. $2 billion or $2 million, something like that. And there's a big difference between those zeros there. But they actually froze the funds when Fisker started going belly up. Matter of fact, I believe they said Consumer Affairs bought one of the Fiskers. They had the vehicle for 2 days and it died. And they've never, ever, ever had a car do that on them before.
Hmm.
Wow.
So, you know, there's more of these crony capitalism scandals out there. Just media is not putting the word out.
Right, correct.
What about Bank of America and what they did to companies, gun manufacturers? Did you guys hear about that one?
I heard a number of things on Bank of America. What about associated with guns?
Yeah, Bank of America, I think, I forget the name of the group, but I just read about it this morning. It was a gun manufacturer that Bank of America stopped doing business with them because they support the Second Amendment. And basically they have decided to withdraw their support from any company that supports the Second Amendment. So as of right now, Bank of America is losing customers at the drop of a dime, and if they don't turn it around based on the millions of gun owners, and there's probably a few million in there who are Bank of America customers, just if a bank loses a million customers, we'll find out if they are too big to fail. Because just say if you have, just say $100 in an account, you times that by a million, considering Bank of America is our largest bank with something like, what was it, like something $100 billion in assets, something crazy like that.
I haven't heard of that one, but I have heard of several American corporations withdrawing support for that state legislature organization, because it supports voter ID, and they're saying that that's racist and they had a few demonstrations, and these people just caved.
Yeah, Bank of America also, during the start of the immigration debate when Obama was running, was giving credit cards to illegal aliens and denying them to legal citizens.
Yes, that's
they've
right.
They've done a lot of stuff. They were allowing illegals to go into the bank, cash checks without ID. And that's when I saw a lot of people bailing from Bank of America. And we've got another caller coming in. Let me bring this person in on the line. Area code 616, you're on the air live with Annie, Sudden Sense. Who am I speaking to?
My name is Mike, and they refer to me as Cool Mike.
Oh, there he is.
He showed up. Wow.
Well, good afternoon, Cool Mike. Cool Mike is my normal host, co-host. So, Cool Mike, chime in.
What? Just, I'll tell you what. Let me mute myself for a minute. I got to take care, just finish up some business, sign on the dotted line, and I'll jump in a second.
Oh, my God. Now, we were talking about crony capitalism, and one of the things I saw recently is that GM is opening up more car dealerships in China, and they are now going to have more car dealerships in China than they have in the entire United States.
Wow.
This is your tax dollars at work. You know, James, how do we stop this outside of voting Obozo out?
Yes, that's how you stop it, not only voting that bozo out, but voting the whole crew out. And I think what really needs to happen is if you exclude California, which didn't get the memo, and you go back to the 2010 election, we need to have as startling a results in 2012 as we had in 2010. And it's got to have as much of a shift in the government. And then I think they'll start to get the message. They'll forget it. And I think a politician, they did a test, and they have a memory of about 3 days. So we've got to keep reminding them, too.
Yeah, that's what we definitely have to do. But I've been telling everyone, you've got to do it on your local level and work your way on up. You've got to start it with the dog catcher all the way on up.
Yes. And this process that I can't remember the name of the guy. That's the guy who used to be head of worked in the White House, and Glenn Beck got him demoted or fired.
Oh,
Van Jones.
Yeah, Van Jones' organization is the one who's going after the state legislator organization, and that just proves that that's working at the local level. Because he's going after what he perceives as the greatest threat to the agenda. So I agree with you. You got to start local and work up.
Absolutely.
I despise that guy. I really do. He's a bald-headed, greasy-looking person who gives people who are conservatives like me a bad name. Because I get lumped in a category with him just because my skin color just happens to be his color.
But you're not bald, right?
Let
me ask a question here. Now, we've got the Westerns covered. We've got some history in there. Any military war novels in the office?
No, I'm going to stick with the Western series, but I'll write a book in between the Western series. I'm getting the Shutmouth Society started off very slow, but it's starting to take off, and I'm getting some email of people wanting the sequel to that. I may go ahead and do that, and that's a Santa Barbara police officer and a UCLA history professor. It's what I call a Robert Ludlum kind of formula book.
Mm-hmm.
But I would probably, and he has a military background, so that's probably as close as I'll get to a military book, is do a sequel to that.
Okay.
Wow. That's interesting. I was going to ask a question now, and Dr. Jones made it go right out the window.
Oh, darn. Now, one of my favorite authors, Mr. Best, is W. E. B. Griffin. of Brotherhood of War, the Corps, and his books are in series so that the characters move from book to book and they advance with an experience and age, and you see their lives unfold throughout 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 books in some cases. Do you have anything, do you have any aspirations of doing anything like that other than with the Westerns?
Yeah, in fact, the Westerns probably were influenced by that. I read the, I remember his first series, I think it was Lieutenants.
Yes.
And then, my mind just went blank, Captains,
part,
Majors.
Part of the
anyway,
Brotherhood of War story.
Each book progressed through the ranks, and it was the same cast of characters. And the Westerns are not really a series so much as a continuation, because there's already three books, and it starts in the summer of 1879, and it's only up to April of 1880, and there's been three books already. So it's like a continuing story of these three characters, and some others, one of them's daughter, and some other recurring characters. Not the bad guys don't recur because they get killed.
Yeah.
How do you come up with new ones?
Yeah, exactly. You can always come up with a good bad guy. I mean, they're disposable.
Right.
Yeah, they're always disposable. We got Cool Mike back on the line. Mike, you back?
Yeah. One of the most amazing things I've noticed, and this is Barack Obama is just, I don't know if he's just really good at it, or in the last 4 years we as people just have become a lot more stupid, is just how out of nowhere they could point to any one of us on the line or any of us in the chat room. That Cool Mike is a bad guy. The media runs with it. Next thing you know, it's no different than this Trayvon Martin case. Next thing you know, people in Alaska will be like, can you believe that Cool Mike? He should be hung after what he's done. When really, it's basically, as you said, easy to create the bad guy. Just, you know, a few bad words, the media runs with it, and off you go.
Right.
I mean, and it's that way with, there are a lot of bad people in this world. We know that. But as we know, Barack Obama's basically, it's no different than they're trying to smear Mitt Romney's wife. Since when did she come to play into this election? But of course, he's diverting from the issues, so you go after his wife. Which, incidentally, he was the one who made the statement 4 years ago, family is off limits.
Right, trying to go after his wife. And
yeah.
Come back with all this indignation.
Yeah, and now they were going after him for his religion, once again, when you have Harry Reid, who happens to be Mormon.
Right. Do you know, there's a lot of conservatives that complain that he keeps blaming Bush. And they want to know when he'll quit blaming Bush. When did they quit blaming Hoover? I don't think they ever did. I think it's still, the Depression was Hoover's fault, and they still blame him for anything that went wrong for a couple decades. So they demonize somebody, and they don't just do it on a transitory basis. They keep it up.
Right, absolutely. Now we're down to our last few minutes here, and James, this has been fun. The hour and a half has gone real fast. I want to thank you for coming on, and I want you to please come back again.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And when's your deadline on your next book?
Well, it's a financial deadline. I need to have it done, edited, and proofread, and in print before Christmas.
Oh, excellent. I look forward to that coming up. And your website, again, is jamesbest.blogspot.com, where people can get your books and read your personal blog.
Correct.
Absolutely. Well, it has been fun. Doc Jones, want to thank you for helping with the co-host here. We've had a lot of fun. And you got a show coming up?
I do, 8 p.m. tonight to 9 p.m. It's going to be great. We're going to talk about the usual stuff.
All right, you're breaking up, Doc.
I really enjoyed your guest, And I'm going to get the books. I'm going to get all the books, and I'm going to read them. And I think I'm going to really enjoy reading your guest books. Thank you so much, Mr. Best. I really do appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to chat with us today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Can I say one quick thing?
Sure.
Yeah, the website is James D. Best.
Oh, all right.
Blogspot.
Okay.
There's
James,
a D in there.
If you want to listen to a show where Barack Obama gets beat down with a bat, listen to Doc Jones. Doc, since you've returned on your vacation, every title of your show has been Obama, King Obama, kill him. Every show is just ripping on him. I mean, we obviously are not supporters of Obama, but I mean, that's very, very true. Doc, who is a retired Marine, his passion to see what's happening to this country, I can understand. I mean, it's a great show. So if you are on Blog Talk Radio someday, listen in. He's on at Monday through Friday at 8 o'clock.
Great.
Yep. Thank you.
Right. And Thomas, you have a show coming up tonight?
I don't do shows Monday, Tuesdays, or Wednesdays anymore.
Okay.
No, I just do shows Thursday, Fridays, and Sundays. But unless I have special guests, then I don't get special guests anymore. Nobody loves me no more. I'm just a little old me. But this
you ever
was a great...
Do you ever go to the telephones, Thomas? Because every time I call your show, I'm on hold for the whole show.
Sound like personal problem. I'm just kidding. But Mr. Best, I am sitting here looking through the Hallmark Channel information, and I am going to see what I can do about finding what the process would be, because I'm sure with it being Hallmark, they've probably heard of your books, and if we could possibly, you know, get that Western series into movies, that would be awesome, because I've actually heard of the series. I've never read them, but I've heard of them. So.
Oh, great.
So.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And someone wrote in the chat room, Dana, she thought that you were the guy who played Roscoe P. Coltrane on the Dukes of Hazzard.
That's why
no.
in there.
Well, James, I want to thank you. And I want everyone out there listening in to know that we will be back on Thursday, not Friday. Thursday, we'll be broadcasting live for the Healing Heroes Golf Week at the Sanctuary on Cat Island here in Beaufort, South Carolina. And this is to benefit the Independence Fund that helps severely wounded warriors. And remember, independencefund.org, out of every dollar you donate, 99 cents go directly to the veterans.
Now, where are you you're broadcasting on the golf course at... At the
restaurant on the golf course.
What's the name of the place?
The Sanctuary.
No, the restaurant.
I believe it's called The Sanctuary.
Okay, well, anyway, anyone listening, get down there so you can be on the radio live with Annie. She'll need lots of company.
Yeah, we will have the wounded veterans there with us, so hopefully we're going to snag a few of them to come on the air with us.
Broadcasting, co-hosting with you from the Pontiac, Michigan 168 AmVets. I decided since you're going to be somewhere helping the vets, I'm going to go to the local post and hang out there and do the Wi-Fi co-host from surrounded by veterans as well.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. So everyone else, have a great night, and I'll see you on Thursday. Good night, and God bless.
Thanks, Doc Jones.
Thank you.
Hey, welcome. Thank you, guys.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.